Today's Taisho will be on Case 21 in the Blue Rock Collection. Chimon's Lotus Flower and Lotus Leaves. Engo's Introduction. Setting up the Dharma banner and establishing the Dharma teaching is like spreading flowers over brocade. If you take off the puzzle and if you take off the muzzle and set down the load, you will enter a time of great peace. If you master the transcendent words, you will be able to know three corners from one. If not, as usual, listen to the following. Main subject. A monk asked Chimon, "What will the lotus flower be when it has not yet come out of the water?" Chimon said, "The lotus flower." "What about when it comes out of the water?" "The lotus leaves." Secho's verse, "The lotus leaves, the lotus flower." He is so kind to tell you of them. The flower coming out of the water, what difference before or after? If you wander about, now north of the river, now south of the lake, questioning Master Wang and the like, as one doubt is settled, another will arise, and you will puzzle over question after question. For those of you who are here for the first time, let me explain that this is a talk on Zen practice known as a Taisho. Usually in the Zen tradition, the subject for these talks are koans from two of our major collections of koans. One of the major collections is called the Gate of No Barrier, and the other is called the Blue Rock Collection. These are often stories of the enlightenment experience or of a question that precipitated an enlightenment experience. So sometimes the stories actually tell about a monk or a nun or a lay person having an awakening experience, an experience of enlightenment. Sometimes they describe an encounter between a teacher and a student just prior to such an experience. And sometimes they give the question that produced the enlightenment experience. So in Zen, it's often the case that people have enlightenment experiences while they're working on a koan. And a koan is generally a story or a question that you internalize when you can enter deep samadhi. So the point of, or the way to use a koan is to sit on the cushion and straighten your back and breathe properly. And when you begin to enter a state in which your mind is very focused and calm, and in which you begin to be less separate from the world around you, and at that stage, you can begin to internalize the koan. And koans generally take the form of a question. And they're questions that are not really answerable with the discriminating intellect. So a famous koan is, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" There's really no intellectual answer. What you have to do is internalize the koan and allow it to work on a non-conscious or subconscious level. So this takes some time. If you're just starting to practice Zen, it takes about anywhere from a month to 6 months to begin to enter samadhi deeply, enter meditative concentration deeply. Once you have been able to do that, the teacher generally gives you a koan. And koans have to be internalized, so you you generally have some phrase or some words you keep repeating as you breathe out. So it's a little bit like a mantra. So in this case, lotus leaves, lotus flower. Lotus leaves, lotus flower. Lotus leaves, lotus flower. Now, you know, you could think that's just nonsense. I'll sit on the cushion and just say, lotus leaves, lotus flower, lotus leaves, lotus flower. What's that all about? If your mind is properly prepared, if you have been able to enter deep samadhi, believe it or not, those words will begin to have a subtle effect on your mind. And little by little, they will produce a kind of opening up inside of you. This is the function of the koan. This is how koans work. They are internalized, become processed, you could say, or worked through on an unconscious level. And they produce a glimpse of fundamental reality, of awakening. Now, usually, one koan doesn't do the trick. Usually, people have to work through a series of koans, and as they work through the koans, they begin to open up to this fundamental reality. So teachers in our tradition often give students the first koan is a breath meditation, and that helps you to enter samadhi. And then once you've begun to enter samadhi, the teacher gives you the mu koan. Now, after the mu koan, there's a whole series of koans, and each time somebody works with a koan, they begin to have this, they eventually have this breakthrough or this opening experience. So you have an opening, and your mental habits are sort of pushed aside for a while, and then they return. And then you have another opening, and then they return, and so on. This goes on for a number of years. Some openings are very hard to achieve, when they happen, they open the mind very much, very dramatically. Little by little, the mind stops closing up so completely. And eventually, it opens and never closes up in the same way again. This is what we call Great Awakening, or Dai Kensho, in the Zen tradition. So, it's hard to say how many koans a person has to work with before he or she will have Dai Kensho. And it doesn't really matter. It's, the important thing is just to, this koan is dealing with what's the important thing. So let me read the koan again. Usually there's an introduction, which was written by the person who collected all these koans, Engo. And he gives you some little hints about what the koan is about. Then there's the main subject, and that's the koan itself. And then a third Zen master, Secho, has written a kind of poems at the end of each of these. So the main subject is as following. The main koan is as following. A monk asked Chimon, Master Chimon, what will the lotus flower be when it has not yet come out of the water? Chimon said, the lotus flower. What about when it is out of the water? Chimon said, lotus leaves. Now, the best way to work with a koan is simply to enter deep samadhi and begin to internalize it in the way I described. Lotus flowers, lotus leaves. Lotus flowers, lotus leaves. Purest Zen practice really wouldn't use an intellectual mind at all. Most of us don't have that much confidence, however, in our true nature. So we might feel that a little explanation is necessary or would be a good idea. So let me just give you a little explanation, just so everybody will be comfortable with this little story. Lotus flowers, lotus leaves, what is this all about? Well, I have a friend of mine. His name is George. If you came here to sit last night, you probably noticed that in the room, there's a door closed usually when you get here, and on the other side there's a room, and in the hallway, and you can usually hear somebody talking on the other side of the door. In fact, even when we do walking meditation, you can hear this guy talking. And he has a big voice. Maybe you've noticed that. So we're all being very quiet in here, and we go out and we do our walking meditation, and you can just hear his voice booming in the other room. And if you come a little early, if you come around 6:30, you'll notice that he has his office in that other area of our complex here. And that there are all these students sitting in chairs waiting to talk to George on a Friday night. See, this is very interesting. Because the campus is almost empty on a Friday night, right? Everybody goes home at 4:30, it's Friday night. And there's just two groups here on Friday night, right? Zen students, right? And George and his students. Sometimes you'll see George outside prior to the arrival of his students, and you'll see him chain-smoking cigarettes. Okay, and he sits outside and smokes and smokes and smokes, and he gets enough caffeine in his system. And then he has a big cup of coffee, and then he waits for his students to come. And he works with his students meticulously. You know, he teaches beginning students, often English as a second language students, who are, you know, require a lot of special attention if you're going to give them a good preparation. And George works with each of them individually on a Friday night, and basically he probably was here after we left. And I've known George for maybe 10 years. He works in the writing program for the English department. And he's one of the hardest working guys I know. He's so diligent. He tries so hard. And he does such a good job. You know, it's my job to look at people's course evaluations at the end of the semester. So we have 200 teachers in our program. And during the summer, I spend a whole week just sitting there reading comments students write about their teachers, because we want to make sure that the students have a decent experience. And if teachers are not doing a good job, we need to know. And of course, many of the teachers in our program are really excellent. And George's evaluations are always outstanding. His students always just say he's done a wonderful job. Now, you know, the interesting thing about George is that he's not a professor. He's what's known as a lecturer. And the difference between a professor and a lecturer is that the professor has like lifetime job, which is so rare in the world. You know, to have somebody say, listen, you've got a job till you die. You know, that's rare, right? Those don't exist very often. And they may not exist in the future, but you know, whenever I hear any professors who are friends of mine complain, I always think you've got to be crazy, you know. You've got a lifetime job. Now, if you're an instructor or lecturer, you don't have a lifetime job. You're hired on a semester-by-semester basis. See? And it's very scary if you begin to think about it, because at any time you could lose your job. Any time, any year, you could lose your job, no matter how long you've been working here, and no matter how good you are. See? So the truth is that, you know, I'm very interested in the coming election, because generally speaking, Democrats fund higher education more generously than Republicans. Not always true, but that's generally the case. So many people in the education establishment are very worried that if Corzine loses, there could be big cuts to Rutgers' budget. And if there's big cuts to Rutgers' budget, people like George get the axe, see. Now, you know, George knows that this is true. He knows that he could lose his job at the end of every year. And in fact, many people get a routine letter at the end of every year that fires them. It doesn't come from me, it's a legal issue. But every year it says, you're fired, you may be renewed. And by the way, I've had a job like this myself, and you do a wonderful job, you work very hard, and at the end of the year you get a letter from the dean that says, congratulations, you're fired, thank you for your hard work. It's psychologically very complicated, yeah? Now the thing that I respect so much about George is that he knows that no matter how hard he works, and no matter how good he is, and how much he tries, you know, if there's a budget cut that's big enough, he's going to have to come into my office, and I'm going to have to cut his job. Now, I personally would, I hope this day never, ever comes. It would be one of the most depressing days. And we have had some big cuts. A few years ago, I had to cut $250,000 from my budget. That's really true. We have a big budget in the English department, but naturally, I protected George's job. But, you know, there's no way to make his job permanent. You have to have special resources to do that, and they aren't around. And George knows that every year he could be fired. And yet, you know, he comes to work and he does an excellent job. He stays on a Friday night until you know, who knows when, helping his students. You know, I just can't tell you how much I admire this chain-smoking maniac. with his coffee in his hand, you know. And sometimes it looks like he forgot to shave, you know. But it's okay with me, you know, because he does such a darn good job. And it's an interesting thing, you know, it's an interesting thing to see somebody try so hard when there's no guarantee of a good outcome. See, now, you know, George is not a Zen master. You know, he doesn't do Zazen. But he has, I think, the right spirit. You know, he has the right spirit. It takes great trust in life to live that way, you know. We all feel, to varying degrees, you know, this insecurity, but it doesn't always stare us right in the face so readily, you know. I have a lifetime job. But you know, don't kid yourself, because you just don't know what how long a lifetime is, right? You know. So I had a good friend of mine here on the campus, who I talked about in the past, who died at a very young age, on a winter's day just a few years ago. He was about the same age I am, you know, and he had gone out to. There was some problem with his car, and he went out to do something on the engine and died. He had some kind of an undiagnosed condition. I mean, the thing about life is that we try to make sure everything's going to be okay. You know, we try to make sure everything's going to be okay. So, you know, if you're a researcher, you try to get a tenured position. Otherwise, you're always dependent on grants. You know, scientists are like my friend George. You know, you all know John Hogan. You know, John Hogan was so good at what he did. Well, he was just like George, you know. He was grant-funded, and if the grant stop coming in, he's out of a job. John was so generous with his time, so, you know, always there for people. And yet, you know, it could all disappear. The rug could be pulled out. You know, we try not to live that way. We try to make sure things are going to go smoothly. But you know, I think it's impossible to do that successfully because there's just too many variables. You know, you can put your money in the stock market, you know, but tomorrow the stock market could crash. You know, this is just, we all know this. And we also know that, you know, who a year ago in New Orleans would have imagined the situation today? You know, would have imagined the situation today. You know, the truth is we try to control life. We try to plan. We try to have a clear view of the future and not have too much uncertainty. But, you know, the truth is that it's impossible to control events as they unfold. And this is what we try never, I think, to look at too carefully. You know, we try never to look at too carefully. We don't want to know that we're sort of walking on the edge of the razor. But we are, you know, but we are, and there's a part of us that knows that. And I think there's nothing more frightening than this, in a way, than the uncertainty of it all. I honestly think that this leaves a big impression on us when we're growing up, that really it's all very uncertain. And so what we try to do is to protect ourselves. Either we try to plan ahead and get all of our I's dotted and our T's crossed, all of the details taken care of. Or we begin to create like psychological barriers so we don't look, you know, so we don't look. As we grow up, you know, as we grow up, we begin to realize that there's this precariousness to life. You know, there's this unpredictability. And this is a huge part plays a huge role in shaping our psychology, I think, really and truly. You know, I mean, you learn this lesson a million times over in your life. So, I remember I was sitting the other day, and I for some reason, out of my storehouse consciousness, I remembered two girls who were older girls who used to play with me when I was a little kid in Baltimore. They were in junior high school, and I was like in the first grade. And they were actually, they liked my mother. And one woman's name was Joyce, and I can't remember the other woman's name. But they would come over and they would take me out when my mother had to go shopping. We would walk around the neighborhood, and they always came to the house and said, "We want to see our boyfriend." And that was me, you know. And I really liked, I mean, like most little kids, I liked to be, you know, I liked to be liked by these girls, you know, because they were kind of cool. Joyce had loafers with pennies in them, remember? That used to be the style. And back then, there were what we used to call toreador pants. They were pants that stopped halfway down your calf, just like the pants now, only they were tight instead of loose. And she wore a white shirt with the tails hanging out. And she rolled up her sleeves, so she was very cool. This was in Baltimore. This was cool in Baltimore. I don't know if it was cool everywhere. But anyway, I was always trying to impress them, you know, because they were big girls and I was a little kid and I was their boyfriend. So I remember I would, you know, like give them my, I gave them like marbles. I would always try to give them little gifts and things. And I always wanted to impress them. I wanted to seem mature. And I remember we all walked out of the house one day, and I was barefoot because it was summer. And we were walking through there were green areas behind the apartment house where we lived, big green field. And we were walking through the field, and I think we were going to have like a little picnic or something. And in this field, there was all this clover. They had planted all this clover, and clover makes little flowers. And the flowers were always full of bees. These were little honeybees. You don't see honeybees much anymore because of environmental problems. But at that time, honeybees were everywhere. And I remember I was trying to impress them, and I was saying, I was talking to them, and I said, you know, you have to be very careful because you could step on a bee. And of course, the next thing I did was step on a bee. And I remember just sobbing, crying, you know, so I wasn't a big boy anymore. I just was wailing, and they took me into the house, and they put my foot in water with baking soda, and then I felt kind of like a fool. You know. I had wanted to impress them and be a big boy, and then I had wound up being an idiot. And they were laughing at me and having a good time when my mother, they were all having a good laugh about me, you know, when my mother came back. It's nothing, right? You know, it's nothing. But it leaves an impression, leaves like a karmic impression. You know, again, I had a at the same period in my life, you know, I had like a little kid's bicycle. It had wheels that were small, and all the other kids in my neighborhood had regular bicycles, adult, or, you know, I don't know if there's such a thing as an adult bicycle in those days, but what I thought of as an adult bicycle looked like the bicycle in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know. So a lot of the kids had these bicycles that are beautiful stenciling on the fender and banner, these things hanging off the handles that flapped in the wind. And people did have like little bells with like a lion's head on the bell and things. So cool. And I wanted a bike like that. And I was too small for one, but I kept nagging my father, my mother, and they didn't have a lot of money, but they eventually bought me a big kid's bike. And I tell you, you know, you know how it is when you're a kid. I dreamed of this bike. I would go to sleep at night, and I would wake up, and I would see my parents and go, you know, I dreamed of a bike last night. You know, and they would just think, oh, brother, here we go again. You know? But I would think, you know, and I had, like, pictures of bikes and things like this. It was just like my obsession. So they bought me a bike, and honestly, it was like my dream come true, right? And so I didn't want training wheels on the bike because that's what little kids had. So my father put me on the bike, and he started pushing me across through the neighborhood, on the sidewalks in the neighborhood. And I really got going very fast. The next thing I knew, I was lying in my living room, and my mother was putting an ice bag on my head. Because I had knocked myself cold somehow. And that really changed the way I looked at my bike. And this is like life, you know. You know, we want certain things, and we sort of trust life, and then the outcome doesn't turn out to be the way we want. And this goes on again and again and again and again. And it leaves a kind of trail, a kind of like karmic trail in our minds. And we become, you know, habitually or instinctively sort of anxious about life because we realize there's a kind of precariousness about it all, right? Precariousness. You just don't know. You know, you think you're going to have a picnic and you step on a bee. You think you're going to ride your bike over to your friends and impress them, and you knock yourself cold. And, you know, this can be more serious. These are like trivial examples, but, you know, mostly our examples are trivial. But, you know, sometimes they're serious. Some of you know Sahana and Pradeep. You know, that Pradeep had just started a new job in the South, and apparently he was leaving his lab and driving home and didn't come home. And, you know, people looked for him in the morning and they found his car had gone off the road and he was in the hospital. He severely injured, severely injured. He doesn't remember what happened because of the injury. So, I mean, this can happen to any one of us. You know, any one of us. And a part of us knows it, right? You know, so, I think this is so central to life and so central to, like, Zen practice. Because, you know, living life is dealing with this constant uncertainty. You know, we want a certain outcome, but we can't be sure it's going to happen. And so when we inhabit the moment, when we live in the moment, we're never really there, right? We're all constantly trying to prepare for the future. And that means being vigilant, bracing ourselves for the worst, calculating best outcomes, and so on and so on. And either that or we're filled with nostalgia or regret, right? Because the past was so much better than the moment we're in now. This is like the human condition. So, you know, you have a wonderful evening out with your friends. Next time you go out, it's not the same. And then you just sit there and wish it could be. And this is the way the human mind works. So this business of being in the moment is very important, very complicated. Because generally speaking, we don't have trust in the moment. We don't have trust in the moment. And so it's very hard for us to be in the moment. And yet, you know, I think that Zen is all about being completely and unconditionally in the moment. Completely and unconditionally in the moment, whatever it brings. This is dramatized when we sit. You know, this is brought home to us when we sit. You know, people come to meditation practice usually some kind of expectation of good results, right? We just finished a sesshin. We just finished our October meditation retreat. And if you haven't done sesshin yet, let me just say, I hope you will. You know, I highly recommend sesshin. It's the essence of Zen practice. It's like the core of Zen practice. People come to sesshin, you know, with high hopes. Most people are in Zen because they want to, quote-unquote, become enlightened. And they have all kinds of ideas about what it means to become enlightened. You know, I sometimes give talks to audiences. I'm invited to speak about Zen practice, and I've mentioned this before, but at one of the talks here on campus, a student raised his hand and said, can Zen monks fly? Can they fly? Because this person had been told they could. And actually I said, not to my knowledge, you know. Or not yet. But actually, birds fly, but Zen monks can't fly. You know, that's just not... But you know, people come to sesshin with all kinds of crazy ideas about what enlightenment is going to be like. You have a goal, enlightenment. And enlightenment is going to be a state in which all of your problems are gone, total bliss, this and that, you know, whatever. And you come to sesshin with these high hopes, which are commendable and wonderful. And then, you know, the darndest thing happens. Because around day two of sesshin, your legs really start to hurt, you know? And your back starts to hurt. And you begin to get tired, you know? And by the end of the day, everything hurts, right? It's like, and you're just trying to get through 25 minutes at a stretch. Right? And it's like all of your beautiful hopes are dashed, right? And you're just stuck in pain. Now, you know, I've just discouraged everybody from coming to sesshin, I guess. But, you know, what often happens to people, or almost always happens to people, is that there's a process they go through, and they are transformed by this experience. Because, you know, you come to Sesshin trying to plan it out and get through it and reach your goal. So, you know, people who have practiced at coming to Sesshin often sort of have strategies, like, you know, I developed these myself. You know, you can sit one way for the first sit and then sit another way the second sit. You alternate, right? So this is like a little breathing. So, you know, if you cross right over left, then do left over right. You know, right over left over right. You know, if you adjust the cushion a certain way, you know, let one hip be a little higher than the other, less knee pain. You know, we all have these strategies, right? You know, maybe if you drink a cup of tea in the afternoon, you won't be so tired, and so we try to. But you know, by day two, it's just all shot to hell. You know, you can right over left over right. You know, right hip higher than left hip, left hip higher. Nothing is really very satisfying. And then you're in the moment, right? You're in the moment. And you have to deal with the moment just as it is. This is the most terrible thing and the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, because, you know, if the moment is not what you want, you can sit there and you can just say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, right? I can't wait till I'm out of here. People come in, we have what's called dokusan. People come in to see me at night and meet with me privately. And, you know, sometimes people say, you know, I'm just counting the days till I'm out of here, or I'm just counting the hours. You know, and I understand, I've been there, you know. It's like, you know, this is not the moment I want to be in. This is not the moment I want to be in. And in fact, this is a very common state of mind. You don't have to be at Sesshin to feel this way. Most people feel this way instinctively all the time. People are nervously trying to move forward out of the present moment almost all the time. You know, it's like, let me out of this moment. The next one has to be better. And for such people, meditation is really often quite impossible. You know, my father was kind of like that. You know, I remember once we went, he was a Boy Scout master. He was a scout master of our scout troop on the base, one of two. And we all went on a hike, a long hike, 50-mile hike. We hiked 10 miles a day when I was a little kid. And I got very sick, maybe from some water I drank or something, and I really was very sick. And so my father stayed behind with me, and we stayed in our tent, and there were also these buildings, these like little log cabins with an open front. And there was a picnic bench in there. We pitched the tent next to that, and we stayed there while the rest of the troop went on and finished the hike. And my father was just alone in this beautiful place with nothing to occupy his mind but the moment. And he went absolutely insane. Because my father was very much a future-oriented person. It's like, let me out of this moment. And so, you know, he smoked all of his cigarettes in about an hour. And then he had a deck of cards, and he sat there playing cards, you know. And you could see, I mean, I was sort of in a haze, but I could see how restless he was, you know. Incredibly restless. You know, this is his mental habit. You know, but we don't all have to be like that, even though that's a typical mindset. You know, people come in here sometime on a Monday night. You can see them just squirming like crazy. They can't stay in the, there's got to be a better moment right around the corner. But what happens to people in Sesshin is so interesting because, you know, you've signed up for 5 days. You want to give it a try. Who knows? Enlightenment could be right around the corner, right? You could leave and that next sit could be the one where you have enlightenment, right? So you think, okay, I'll stick it out. And, you know, basically what happens to people is they go through a kind of transformation. It's really predictable. You know, so many people come in day two and say, oh, it's not going very well, I'm depressed, I'm bummed out, I have a lot of pain. You know, day three or day four, they come in and go, oh, everything is so beautiful, everything is so wonderful. I've been in heaven all day. See, this happens all the time at Sesshin. And what happens to people is that suddenly they just give up and they stop trying to control things and they're just in the moment as it unfolds. And, you know, when you stop trying to control the moment, you become one with the moment, because you are one with the moment. You know, and if you think about it, you know, there's no sense trying to control it. You can't control it, even a little bit. You know, all you can control is your response to the moment. Right? This is your chance to change your life, is how you respond to the moment as it unfolds. And so this koan is sort of about how we live in the moment. A monk asked Chimo, what will the lotus flower be when it has not yet come out of the water? Chimo said, the lotus flower. What will it be when it is out of the water? Lotus leaves. You know, this desire for a better moment than the one we're in is very interesting. Very interesting, because there's versions, different versions of this mentality. You know, some people think that we're here on Earth for a limited period of time, and then we're going to go to heaven. And Earth will be like, the heaven will be like Earth, only really much better. See, much better. Like ice cream every day, won't gain weight, you know, it'll be great. No traffic, you know, no waiting for the good restaurants. So this is like deep part of human psychology. You know, our dreams of heaven are really, in a certain sense, not about heaven, are they? They're about being right here now, and how unsatisfactory it is to be right here now. It's like, but there's bound to be a better place. And this is like a fundamental human belief, like a better world, a better life. You know, some people come to Zen meditation because what they want is to like transcend. It's like this filthy world. You know, and I think we all experience this. You know, I think the other day I was meditating, and I remembered this experience I had where I was trying to get to a party on the base where I was when I was a boy, and I had nice clothes, I'd gotten dressed up, and I wanted to ride my bike to the party. And it was like this whole sequence of events happened to me. First of all, I got a flat tire. And I don't know if you ever have, I have recurring dreams of having a flat tire on my bike, you know. Those of you who are psychoanalytically inclined can, you know, make of that what you want, you know. But I have the dreams where I'm trying to ride my darn bike up the hill and I've got a flat tire, or two, you know. I realize, why can't I go anywhere? And I look down, the tires are flat. Well, that was what happened to me that day, right? And I think, you know, I tried to fix the tire and I got goo all over my shirt or something. And I was so damn mad and disappointed. Right? This is so human, right? Life seems to thwart us, right? It's just like life thwarts us. It just made me furious at life, you know. I just got so mad. And, you know, in those moments, you know, and they don't have to be as trivial as that, you know, I wish I were somewhere else, and you think this filthy, lousy world, you know, this stupid, lousy world, this is a dirty, filthy place. It's a terrible place, right? And we all have those moments. And you think, I'm going to transcend, right? Going to transcend. You know, in to one way of thinking, you know, what we're doing on the cushion is transcending, right? Transcending, getting out of all this filth, all of this stupidity, all this disappointment. It's like you could think of our practice as like a lotus of purity and light growing out of the mud and confusion. But actually, I think that would be 100% wrong. See, 100, that's not just wrong, that's like 120%, 150% wrong. Because actually, this is the lotus. See, this world is Buddha. There isn't anywhere else. Heaven isn't anywhere else. Always so. This is the lotus. This is the lotus. So, you know, we sit on the cushion and we say, enlightenment, please come. And this is another way of saying, let me out of here. Let me out of here. You sit on the cushion and your legs hurt and your back hurts, you're tired, maybe you have a cold, you feel lousy, you're not focused, and you think there's got to be a better moment than this. But what happens to people on day 3 of Sesshin, and sometimes on a Saturday sit too, is you sit there and think, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, and then suddenly, it's like a switch goes off in your mind, right? And you suddenly feel this tremendous sense of, it's like I'm home. I'm in my mother's arms, you know? And everything around you is alive. If this hasn't happened to you yet, I swear it'll happen, you know? Every Sesshin for me, it's like the same thing, you know? About day 3 of Sesshin, everything around me is like beautiful, perfect, my true home, you know, and I feel so happy and at ease. And this is how life can be. But, you know, the secret is just saying, we in Buddhist tradition and in Indian tradition generally, you put your hands together, this gesture. This is like a saying, I give myself to you. This is like a namaste, I give myself to you. Whatever I encounter in the moment is just as it should be. I give myself to the moment. And that's so hard to do, but the minute we do it, you know, this world changes into paradise. Paradise. So, you know, one way to think about Zen practice is that we're transcending. But another way to think about Zen practice, much better way to think about Zen practice, is that we're learning how to be in the moment, wholeheartedly in the moment, with no expectations about outcome, whether we quote-unquote become enlightened or not is really quite unimportant. The minute we say to the moment, you are me, I am you. This is my true self. We're already enlightened. That is enlightenment itself. After that, it's easy. It's just get back there as often as you can and dwell in that state for as long as you can. You know, do your legs hurt? That's Buddha. Are you sick this morning? That's Buddha. Are you tired? That's Buddha. People say to me, I didn't have a very good sit. I was tired. It's like, you don't understand. That's Buddha. You know, that's Buddha. So this is Zen practice, right? Learning to be what we always are. You know, learning to be where we always are. Engo's introduction. Setting up the Dharma banner and establishing the Dharma teaching is like spreading flowers over brocade. See, in other words, trying to be Buddha is like spreading flowers over the brocade. Right? Brocade is already beautiful. happens. It's already beautiful. This moment is intrinsically perfect. Now, trying to accomplish something other than being in the moment is like, we say in English, gilding the lily. It's like already perfect. The moment's already perfect. If you take off the muzzle and set down the load, you will enter a time of great peace. We all have to come here and sit on the cushion and say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, until boom. We give up, right? You just give up and you say, fine. And suddenly everything is beautiful. Everything is beautiful. If you master the transcendent words, you will be able to know three corners from one. If not, listen to the following. Main subject. A monk asked Chimo, what will the lotus flower be when it has not yet come out of the water? So this is all about, what's the next moment going to be like? See, what's the next moment? Is it going to be a good one? Is it going to be a good one? Shimon said, it's going to be the next moment. What about when it's out of the water? Buddha, just Buddha, always Buddha. Secho's verse. The lotus leaves, the lotus flower, he is so kind to tell you of them. The flower coming out of the water, what difference does it make, before or after? If you wander about, now north of the river, now south of the lake, looking for a better minute, looking for a better moment, questioning Master Wang and the like, as one doubt is settled, the next will arise. And you will puzzle over question after question. Every moment is Buddha. Every moment is the same moment. And all we ever have in this life is this moment. That's all we ever have. You know, so if you want to know what enlightenment is, you know, be in this moment. And if you can just do that a little tiny bit, if you just do that a little tiny bit today, you know, that's what Zen practice is all about. So, if not today, next moment. It's always present, always available.